Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
Scott Air Force Base in Illinois is home to a brand new building, 164,000 square feet devoted to cybersecurity. It's the Global Operations Command of the Defense Information Systems Agency. Colonel Paul Kraft, the commander, described the new center in an interview with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu.
I would say 70% of DISA Global is here in Illinois, along with those two cyber protection teams, roughly about 1,000 folks here at the main headquarters. But we also have, you get to call them battalions or squadrons that are located in Columbus, Ohio, in Springfield, Virginia, down in Montgomery, Alabama, Pensacola, Florida. We have other locations that have other capabilities within the command that are both operationally controlled or direct supported or assigned to DISA Global Operations Command. So, but the majority of our command is within this new facility.
Yeah. So talk a bit about what that brings to the table in terms of just consolidating so much of that global workforce into one physical location.
Sure. So the DISA Global, as I mentioned before, is the lead for operating and defending the infrastructure and services that make up the Department of Defense's information network. That includes some major capabilities like the internet access points, so DoD's access to the internet. We run that and defend that from here. The Joint Regional Security Stack is a very, very important cyber defensive capability within the Department of Defense. NIPRNET and CIPRNET are non-secure and secure internet protocols. Also voice and video services. Our mobility devices and also cloud gateways are operated and defended from here. We also have the mission here in this new facility of mission assurance to ensure that all the airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, remotely piloted aircraft circuits, global missile defense, nuclear command and control, and White House circuits are also supported. And that is the majority. That is roughly about 800 folks within the building. And then JFHQ Doden, again, has two embedded cyber protection teams. Cyber protection teams are about 39 personnel each that are also embedded onto our floor. So inside this facility, we're able to work with our specific customers in the defense of the network, also operations of the network, supporting combatant commands, defense agencies, federal agencies, and also the clear defense contractors.
Gotcha. Okay. Since you brought up JRSS, the department leadership has talked so extensively about JRSS in terms of, as the military services converge around those, just adding so much more capability to see down into service-specific and DoD agency-specific networks to be able to, you know, have that situational awareness so that you can operate and defend the network and monitor them from a facility like yours, I would imagine. How much is that JRSS convergence kind of baked into the go-forward plan for DISA Global?
It is. So JRSS is central to what we do here. So the Global Operations Center for JRSS is embedded into DISA Global here in Illinois. So not only do we run and defend JRSS from here around the world for all the JRSS stacks as they stand up, but we're also responsible with our joint migration teams to actually help our customers, like the Army that was here this week, of getting their post camps and stations onto JRSS system itself. So clearly we're an advocate for JRSS. It's a great system. The more folks realize the quality of service that you get out of it from a network perspective and from a defensive perspective, from a DCO perspective, more and more folks are going to want to use this system. It is a great defensive capability that's coming online right now.
So even though these are regional centers, they're still kind of centrally overseen from right there at Scott?
They are regional stacks, but everything is centrally managed from here, yes.
So talk about...
We actually operate and defend the stacks from here.
Talk about the future a little bit, if you would. The announcement that you folks put out a few weeks ago talked about the fact that beyond the 950 civilian and military and contract employees that have already come to Scott, there are some plans for future growth. So what's the plan ahead?
So the facility has the flexibility currently on how it's configured to allow for modifications as new missions emerge and our workforce grows to meet those needs of the warfighter. But in the near term, actually, DISA and the senior leaders of Illinois have been our advocates to expand on this building already, just based on what we know we already can do. This potential expansion would create additional opportunity for DISA to employ additional resources that are really vital to counter the emerging threats of our nation.
Are there any specific attributes about Scott and the general region around you that made this a logical place to put DISA Global, either in terms of just floor space or the local organic workforce? Why does Scott make sense for this?
Well, I'll say the Air Force has been a great partner of DISA, and Scott Air Force Base is a great location in the center of our country, right outside St. Louis, to have a great area for people to be hired. There is a major cyber capability here that the Air Force has. They have 15 cyber protection teams on this base also, along with the 688th Cyber Operations Group. There's the Air Force's NIC is also here. So there are major IT and cyber capabilities for the Air Force here. We've always been here. We've been here for more than 20 years. As an agency, DISA has, and we just have been continued to grow that capability here in the center of the country to provide that operation support globally at Scott Air Force Base.
And I know that at least some portion of this workforce is civilian. Was some of that hired organically from the St. Louis area, or did you have to do a fair amount of relocation from other parts of the country as you did this consolidation?
I would say a good portion of the folks that we hire are actually from the local area, but we are actually going through a hiring process right now. We've got about a 20%, 25% growth in civilian, DOD civilian jobs here within the command, and we have received resumes from around the world, folks that want to come and work in this environment, in this facility supporting global operations.
I think you mentioned earlier that you're bringing in some Army reserve teams to work in the facility in addition to the CPTs that you've already got from Air Force and Marine Corps. Overall, what's the Guard and Reserve role in what you're trying to do there?
So we are integrating the Compo 3 Army Reserve and actually Air Force Reserve officers and NCOs into our real world current operations. The reserves, Army Reserves, have known as the Army Reserve Element of DISA, are located in Colorado and in Alabama and in Missouri. And they come in and we are working through to get them trained to conduct both, I'll say, network operations, but also defensive cyberspace operations, because we have the ability to do training here and obviously a very large floor to conduct operations. So, and that's also for the Army Reserve Element, the Air Force Reserve Element that is here also. So, it's been a major effort to get the reserves integrated into here, and we're continuing to work toward having them fully integrated to support us on both weekends and then major times throughout the year.
Hmm. And as I understand it, this facility sounds like it was basically purpose-built to be a large cyber operations center. As you put together the plan for this facility, what were the sorts of creature comforts that you decided you needed to have specific to this mission?
So we have the well-being of our, I'll say, of our workforce has been the number one focus for what we do here, and obviously people are the backbone for the missions that we support and the continuity for those missions going forward. So we do have not only the largest, I'll say, cyber operations center in the DoD, but we also have a 3,200 square foot wellness center here open to all DISA employees 24/7 on site in the facility. We also have an APES restaurant that's with healthy food options for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and it's also open on weekends. And then we have a world-class training facility and conference center and teaming rooms within this new facility that can bring us hands-on training on site, establishing also a communications university here through CECOM, Army CECOM, and also collaborating with organizations both inside and outside the DoD to include academia from St. Louis and in the Illinois region.
And finally, I guess one of my last questions would be, since cyber defense is not exclusively a DoD mission, especially when we're talking about protecting things besides strictly military networks, any connections you want to talk about with other elements of government outside of the DoD, like DHS or the NCIC or other civilian agencies?
So we do have obviously connections to other entities outside of the DoD, and we continue to strive to improve on our technologies and relationships when it comes to defensive cyberspace operations, because it certainly is a team sport. In that effort, we work closely with industry, and again, I've talked about academia, but also the federal agencies to improve collaboration and also defensive measures. As always, we're going to continue to seek out and encourage new collaboration opportunities. Obviously, we have meetings with industry. Industry comes here, and we go see industry. And we're also prepared to collaborate with any of those other partners as directed by DISA and by JPG.
Colonel Paul Kraft is commander of the Defense Information Systems Agency's Global Command Center. Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
When trying to sell cars, Packard Motor used to say, ask the man who owns one. When it comes to the F-35 fifth generation fighter, the Air Force might want to say, ask the man or woman who flies one. That's what the Heritage Foundation did in creating comprehensive assessments of the new platform. I spoke with J.V. Venable, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Policy at Heritage, about his findings.
Well, Tom, the F-35 has been the punching bag for many folks for a long time, and no matter what your bias is going in, whether you're favorable for defense or not, you get colored by all of the news and the media that you hear. Fighter pilots are by their very nature skeptical, and I'm one of those guys. It'll never leave my blood. And so I started looking at the F-35 both from a skeptic standpoint and from somebody who has experience in that profession, and decided to go out and ask the guys who were actually flying the jets what they thought about it. And what they told me was quite startling. And that was the foundation of this article.
So what is the overall assessment from the pilots?
The overall assessment is that this is worth the money that we're paying for it, that it is an extraordinary fighter that has faculties that are beyond anything that they've flown in the past. Their air-to-ground background, so most of the guys that I talked to, with the exception of two pilots, were all in the bomb-dropping or multi-role industry, meaning they did both bomb-dropping and air-to-air dogfighting for a living. And by and large, the take from each one of them was that they would much rather be flying this jet into combat in any situation than they would in their previous jet.
I have to ask this. How do you know that they were speaking, I guess, spontaneously to you, that the Air Force, you know, some general wasn't standing behind them, glaring at them when they were giving you these assessments?
Well, Tom, it's a great question. The first way I knew that is when I walked in, I was received just like any outsider is in a fighter squadron, with skepticism and a bit of piss and vinegar, if you will. They all are brusque in their nature, and they were no different with me. And when I sat down and started talking to each one of them, they held that attitude as I asked them about the details of their old fighter. And when I went down and started asking them to brag more or less about the jets that they had flown in the past and give me their assessments of how each of those jets do, whether they flew F-16s or F-15Cs or F-15Es or A-10s in the past, how they thought it performed in each one of the areas in air combat and in the surface attack mode. And when I got that as a foundation and I knew that they were speaking genuinely there, then each individual had to answer the same questions about the F-35, and they had to use their own answers for their previous jets as that baseline. And that was the phenomenal series of questions that followed and the revelations that came beyond. As you could tell if someone was listening to your question. I asked the first F-16 pilot how he thought the visibility was in the F-16 cockpit, and he rated it as a 5. And then I asked him about the visibility in the F-35, and he said, oh, it's a 5. And I said, you answered that for the F-16. I flew the F-16, and you're saying that the F-16 has the same visibility as it does in the F-35? And that pilot said, oh, no, I'm sorry, you're exactly right. That's a 3.8. And from that point on, I got the ground truth. And there's no question in my mind, to come back to you, Tom, I know that they weren't feeding me something that somebody else had told them to say. There was no way they could have gotten away with it in themselves in that conversation.
Now, you've mentioned a lot of things that fighter-type aircraft are designed to do, drop bombs, shoot down other planes, shoot down things on the ground, and now surveillance and reconnaissance even, I think, is part of the whole mission here. What does the F-35 in particular do well that advances it beyond the earlier planes that you mentioned?
Well, if you were to just go back to an F-16, an F-16 was designed to be able to fight its way into a target, but its primary job was to get to that target and drop it, its bombs, hit a target with precision, and then make it back home. And so this fundamental premise of a multi-role fighter's primary job is to go in and strike something, hit something on the ground, is what the F-35 was designed to do. And it was also designed to go in and be able to defeat threats that may be coming up and trying to stop it from doing that. The F-35, and in the assessment of these fighter pilots, was better, marketably better, at doing the air-to-ground mission, just straight up, than anything that they had seen before. It can find, fix, and destroy targets faster and with greater precision than anything that they've flown to date. But what is extraordinary in their description was the amount of situational awareness that the jet gave them that no other fighter had given them up to that point. And when situational awareness is your ability to know exactly what's happening around you in real time. And that is something that when I was flying jets, if you were in a dogfight, a big fur ball, and you had wingmen that were 2 or 3 miles away engaged in their own fight, you're trying to build a mental picture in your mind about what's happening over 3 miles away from you while you're trying to kill your adversary. And that is very challenging, particularly when you've got the equivalent of a sumo wrestler sitting on your chest underneath the high G's of fighting the fight. This airplane will build that picture for you and sustain it even when you're not looking or thinking about what your wingman is doing. You can look down at the display that's right in front of you in the F-35 and see what's going on. But more importantly, all of the data that's really important to a fighter pilot is displayed in their helmet. And so if they knew a fight was happening 3 miles to the east of them, all he has to do is look to the east, and the jet has tracked the other airplanes through its distributed aperture system. It's an IR ability to track other aircraft all around the F-35. And the jet, when you turn your head and look, it will actually put boxes over friendlies and enemies alike in the vicinity of your aircraft or further away from it, and allows you to get instantaneous situational awareness of what's happening over there. That's the extraordinary additive of this jet.
We're speaking with J.V. Venable, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Is there anything that it could improve on?
It will be undergoing improvements, Tom, for the next 40 or 50 years, and that's the great good. I know people see that as a bad thing, but it's the great good. It will allow this fighter to keep up better with the growing technology that's out there and the explosive technology that is going to continue to rise over the years in front of us. It's going to allow it to keep up with that in the years ahead. In the more near term, and I think that's where your focus is, the jet's got a lot of problems. When I say that, it's got a lot of issues that are going to be resolved in this concurrent development timeline. Right now, the jet and the IOC, and that's initial operation capability declaration that the Air Force just made on the jet.
Right.
That means it can go out and it can be employed in combat, but in a limited way. The jet right now was supposed to be, in the IOC declaration, was supposed to be able to go out, fight its way into a target with long-range missiles, and then be able to drop precision-guided munitions on targets on the ground. And it can do that, and it can do it very well. What it can't do right now, it doesn't have the ability to strafe targets on the ground. The gun sight is not basically put into the helmet, helmet-mounted sight, as of this particular point in its development. That will happen by next summer when the jet is declared FOC, full operating capability, and they bring in the last variant, the last major version of software. When that happens, the jet will be able to do its entire mission very well. But for the foreseeable future, the jet will continue to be refined and polished in a sense of its faculties. And that's going to allow our pilots to dominate the skies for many years to come.
It sounds like most of the advances are the result of electronics, more so than anything new in the shaping or the airframe itself. I mean, it's still two wings with an engine down the middle and a guy sitting on top.
Fundamentally, you're right. But let me just talk about the physical differences. This is the biggest motor that's ever been put in a Western fighter. And that's an extraordinary advance in and of itself. It is massive thrust that goes out the backside of that. But then you have a second side, which I think is really important. The skin on this airplane is now very durable. If you go back to the F-117, the B-2, even the F-22, you couldn't park those airplanes out in the open sunshine because the open sun would deteriorate the skin of the airplane. If you flew through rain, particularly if you flew through any form of hail, it would damage the skin and not allow the jet to retain its stealth capability, its stealth signature. This airplane's different. You can stand on the wing of the F-35 and dig your heel into it, or try to, and you won't change the signature or the stealth faculties of the jet one iota. That is an extraordinary leap. And what you'll see right now in press from China and Russia is they're developing stealth technology, but they're finding out how very hard it is. And they've got another 15 to 20 years to make up with research and development or pilfering of ours in order to be able to field something that even begins to compete with the skin coating of this jet.
So bottom line, you feel that the Air Force and the DOD should go ahead and with the program as envisioned with some more than 2,000 copies?
Yeah, I do. The Air Force is going to purchase on the order of 1,700 jets. It's a little bit more than that. But each of the services has purchases that will take this up above 2,000. And then you've got foreign sales that are going to take it almost to 3 as the numbers are playing out right now. But this is one of the things that is very hard to understand. I really enjoy what I learned about the F-35, and I think that the fighter pilots are even bigger fans than what you're starting to read in the press right now about the jet. But scrutiny and the hard facets of demands that will come from the fighter community and Congress and the media, people like you, Tom, we've got to stay on the program. We've got to stay on industry because that friction is going to make this an extraordinary fighter, and it's going to force Lockheed Martin and every other vendor that's associated with this jet to work their butts off to make sure they deliver it on time and as close to budget, if not under, as they possibly can.
John Venable is Senior Research Fellow for Defense Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Read the report and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.